This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on December 4th, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. We will now begin the open session of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, December 4th, 2008. Mr. Vice Chair, I understand we have a correction and approval of the minutes into document number 0842.
That's correct. So I move approval of that particular agenda document 0842, which are the minutes of the November 20th, 2008 open meeting.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion passes 6-0. For the next, next item up is draft advisory opinion 2008-17 from Kip Bond's campaign committee and Kip Peck. My sense, I've had several of my colleagues come to me and say they would like a little more time, both on the analysis and some of the drafts and maybe even the conclusion on some of the issues. So my sense is that there's enough of a consensus to hold this over, and we have an open meeting scheduled in 2 weeks and consider it then. And I would rather, if we have an opportunity to be more comfortable, give that opportunity as opposed to getting it done for the sake of getting it done. I understand from council that the 60-day statutory outlier doesn't run till
December 23rd.
So we still have some time while still maintaining our statutory obligations. What I don't have is a sense of my colleagues is whether they'd like council to present today so they get maybe it helps their thinking, or do we just hold the matter over? I leave that to others. If someone wants to hear from council, we're here now. If not, there seems to be enough sense to hold it over. Any thoughts or comments on how to proceed? Hearing none, we'll just hold the matter over. Thank you. Appreciate you being prepped and ready to go, and this was a last minute thing, so we don't like to have you prep and then and not do it, but we appreciate it nonetheless that you're here and ready to go. Next up, Mike Gravel for President 2008, determination of ineligibility and letter of candidate and committee certification and agreement.
Good morning. The issue before the commission today is whether Senator Mike Gravel is eligible to receive public matching funds for his primary campaign. This office recommends that the commission determine that he was not eligible to receive matching funds. Before you are two related documents. First, a draft notice of initial determination of ineligibility, which is dated February 15, 2008, and second, a supplemental memorandum dated June 20, 2008, which analyzes Senator Gravel's arguments that he is eligible to receive matching funds. We recommend that the commission approve the draft notice and make an initial determination that Senator Gravel and Mike Gravel for President 2008 is not eligible to receive matching funds. In order to receive matching funds, a presidential primary candidate must make a number of certifications and agreements in a letter to the commission, as well as a threshold submission of matchable contributions meeting certain requirements. One of the certifications that every candidate seeking matching funds must make is that he has not and will not incur expenditures in connection with his campaign in excess of the expenditure limitations. There are three different expenditure limitations, the overall and state-by-state expenditure limitations that apply to the expenditures by a candidate's campaign, and the $50,000 personal expenditure limitation that applies to the personal funds of a candidate and his family, which is at issue here. The personal expenditure limitation states that no candidate shall knowingly make expenditures from his personal funds or funds of his spouse and immediate family in connection with his campaign for nomination which exceed $50,000 in the aggregate. Senator Gravel loaned more than $50,000 to his campaign before he applied for matching funds. He loaned his campaign $73,516. He has submitted documentation indicating that his campaign repaid him $25,900, leaving a balance of $47,616. Thus, Senator Gravel's application for matching funds raises the novel issue of whether a candidate may still be eligible for matching funds if he has previously loaned in excess of $50,000 to his campaign, but has been repaid a portion of it so that on the data that he applied for matching funds, he fell below the $50,000 limit. We conclude that he is not eligible. Senator Gravel knowingly and substantially exceeded the $50,000 personal expenditure limitation when he loaned more than $50,000 to his campaign, even though he was repaid some of the loan amount prior to seeking matching funds. Once he went over the $50,000 personal expenditure limitation, Senator Gravel could never become eligible to receive matching funds. The over $73,000 in loans is substantially in excess of the $50,000 personal expenditure limitation. The amount in excess of the limit is more than $23,000, nearly half of the entire limit. The reduction in the outstanding loan balance did not make Senator Gravel eligible for matching funds. We reached this conclusion for several reasons. First, a candidate cannot be eligible if he exceeds the $50,000 personal expenditure limitation before applying for matching funds. The regulations require a candidate to certify that he and his authorized committees have not incurred and will not incur expenditures in excess of the limitations. The commission may determine a candidate to be ineligible if he knowingly and substantially exceeded the expenditure limitations prior to his application for certification. Second, the commission deliberately added the phrase have not incurred and will not incur to apply the expenditure limitations retrospectively to expenditures made by a candidate from the time he became a candidate before applying for matching funds. In the explanation and justification for that rule, the commission reasoned that the legislative history and underlying purpose of the statute support both prospective and retrospective application. The commission stated that retrospective application of the limitations to candidates who seek matching funds is consistent with the manifest purpose of the statute. The commission said it would run counter to the very purpose of the public financing statute to allow candidates who knowingly, willfully, and substantially exceed the expenditure limitations prior to seeking certification to subsequently receive public funds. Such an outcome would permit a candidate to make vast amounts of campaign expenditures and nevertheless receive matching payments, thereby defeating the basic purpose underlying the enactment of public financing. Finally, allowing Senator Gravel to be eligible after he loaned more than $50,000 to his campaign could open the door to future candidates to circumvent the $50,000 personal expenditure limit by loaning their campaigns much larger amounts. A wealthy candidate who loans millions of dollars in seed money to start his campaign and later repays himself with fundraising proceeds should not remain eligible for matching funds because that would undermine the purpose of the personal expenditure limitation and would provide an unfair advantage over candidates who did abide with the limitation. I'd like to note some factual updates and revisions to the draft notice. On footnote 2 of the notice, we discussed the committee's failure to file reports. And after the document was circulated, the committee filed some of its reports late and filed subsequent disclosure reports. So we would revise the footnote to delete the second sentence of footnote 2. In addition, footnote 5 states that the committee had not filed a threshold submission, but the committee has now filed a threshold submission. So we would revise footnote 5 to delete the first sentence of footnote 5. Therefore, this office recommends the commission make an initial determination that Senator Mike Gravel is ineligible to receive matching funds because he knowingly and substantially exceeded the $50,000 personal expenditure limitation prior to applying for matching funds, approve the notice, and approve the appropriate letter. If the commission approves these recommendations, Senator Gravel may submit written factual and legal materials within 20 days demonstrating that he has not knowingly and substantially exceeded the personal expenditure limitation, and the commission would then make a final determination. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. There's it's before us because we've had three commissioners object. I'm one of them, so I will try to articulate my objections, and they are long and lengthy because I must say I disagree respectfully, of course, with the council. I think Senator Gravel is entitled to matching funds, and I think we can get there in a variety of reasons, some very big constitutional grounds and that sort of thing, if that's how you like to decide things, and then very narrow factual grounds for those who don't like to create new rules or open loopholes or that kind of thing, and I can try to walk through them. But it does raise the issue of matching funds and public financing, and many have observed it's a broken system and have used that sort of rhetoric, and I don't think it's our job to decide whether or not it's broken, but it certainly is our job to try to make it work the best we can, at least how I would define how to make it work, is to try to make it simpler, not more complicated, and have less of an emphasis on form over substance. And I think the analysis presented to deny the senator his matching funds does just that. It puts form over substance. Senator spent some of his own money that was spent on things, so he says, and we have no reason to doubt his word because he did submit an affidavit on compliance, travel, and other things that are ordinarily not subject to the actual matching fund expenditure limits. Whether or not the word expenditure means the same thing once you get the money as opposed to before you get the money, or at least in the context of spending money other than your own money, seems to me it probably does mean the same thing, at least in the context of matching funds. That's an issue I'll flesh out in a minute. Some may disagree on that. I think council disagrees on that. But it seems to me the terms should at least probably be read the same way, unless it leads to absurd results. And I don't think reading them to mean the same thing here leads to an absurd result. But he spent slightly, I think, a little bit more than $50,000. He spent about $73,000 of his own money. But prior to asking for matching funds, these funds were repaid. So when he actually sought an eligibility determination, he was below the $50,000 threshold. So we have a situation where a candidate for president spent some of his own money and then later decided to apply for matching funds and then to be able to certify that he wouldn't incur or hadn't incurred, at least as of the date of the request, more than $50,000. He managed to retire the debt, so to speak, and get below the $50,000. Looking at the statute, I think the statute's clear on its face, and it says that a candidate and his authorized committees will not incur qualified campaign expenses. This is the context of how you're going to be eligible. So it says, read the full passage, to be eligible to receive payments under Section 9037, a candidate shall certify to the commission that, one, the candidate and his authorized committee will not incur qualified campaign expenses in excess of the limitations on such expenses under Section 9035. And to me, I read that as, I think, the only way to read that statute, as forward-looking. To be eligible, you will certify that you will not incur. That is not looking in the rearview mirror. That is only looking down the highway. The regulation says something a little bit different. It says that the candidate and the candidate's authorized committee shall certify that they have not incurred and will not incur expenditures in connection with the candidate's campaign for nomination. I think you can read that reg one of two ways. Council reads that reg as the commission's intentional effort to impose a prospective requirement. If that is the case, that is in conflict with a statute that speaks clearly to the issue. And as we've learned in the various Shays litigations, we've had recent lessons on Chevron deference. When the statute speaks clearly, the reg can't undo or change the statute. It must merely implement the language of the statute. So to sort of impose through regulation what was not obtained through legislation seems to me to cause the reg to fail on its face. But we don't have to get into whether or not we're going to throw the reg off the books, because the reg is on the books. It's been on the books for a long time, and I'm going to assume it was not done to change the statute. Even though I heard today something that, at least what I took from the presentation, that's essentially what the reg was intended to do. I think what the reg, I think a better way to read the reg is that it says you have not incurred, and to me, I read it as a temporal limit, meaning as of the when you file for the matching funds. Much of the matching funds regime seems to be, and taxpayer money used for elections in general, seems to be based on timing. And I don't think that it's something that you would allow you to look in the rearview mirror and disqualify somebody because they had exceeded that threshold long before they applied. So statute, I think, entitles him to matching funds. The reg, read consistent with the statute, also entitles him to matching funds. The ENJ for the reg is curious because it cites the reason as essentially creating a level playing field. As council accurately conveyed what the ENJ says, that the main purpose of the matching funds was to ensure equality. Unfortunately, that's really not what the Congress said at the time they passed it because, well, this went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court in Buckley in the per curiam opinion actually tells us. And, of course, they come back to the corruption or appearance thereof rationale. And, in fact, another portion of the Buckley opinion, they get into the O'Brien test, and they state that the idea of equal speech doesn't fly. So we can't come at this that we're going to base a reg on a rationale that is not the constitutionally permissible rationale. Certainly equality of candidate funding and that sort of thing are probably legitimate policy concerns, but it certainly cannot be read, particularly a reg passed post-Buckley, as the main basis. And of course the ENJ is not the reg itself, and I think that the Buckley opinion would trump the ENJ because I don't see them as consistent, which allows me to read the reg in a way that would entitle Senator Gravel the matching funds. Turning to get more into the weeds, and I'm starting big and I'm going to go more narrow, counsel for Senator Gravel, who actually was a former chair of this agency and been here for many, many years, Scott Thomas, makes a very interesting argument, one that I hadn't thought of. And he raises the question, what is an expenditure? I alluded to this in the beginning, that the sort of spending that occurred here was on things, for the most part, I think about 80%, on things that would otherwise not be subject to the expenditure cap. I'm persuaded by his argument to a certain extent. I think maybe someone could punch a hole in it and say, well, that could open a loophole and that would allow for massive amounts of self-spending and that kind of thing. Perhaps that's possible in the abstract, but in this case, we're talking about $23,000 over the $50,000. So there is no massive loophole here. So I think the argument, at least as applied to these facts, works. Turning to commission precedent, we have dealt not with this particular issue before, but issues that I think are similar, and at least principles that arise from those issues, those other issues that are equally applicable here. Council in its brief acknowledges this is a novel issue, so we're here really as a case of first impression. But there are other cases that I think, as I mentioned, do hold some, if not persuasive, authority. Certainly are, in my mind, things that really announce legal concepts that control this issue. There was a time where the commission allowed someone who spent money in excess of $50,000 while testing the waters was still able to qualify for matching funds. That was a long time ago when the testing the waters rules were different. But the principle I think I take from that is that there's a situation where someone broke the $50,000 cap, and this was back in 1983, much closer to when the statute was passed, and I think it didn't raise alarm bells per se, and I think that's something we can look at. Although, like I said, the testing the waters rules have changed, so the AO is really technically not good law anymore. Then we turn to what we've done in various audits. Most recently, we had Mr. Sharpton come in, and he was denied because there was already over $50,000 of spending the day that he actually applied for the matching fund. So we can distinguish Sharpton on that fact alone. I think the case that's more applicable is the Pat Buchanan situation from 1996. Mr. Buchanan qualified for matching funds, received the funds, and then proceeded to use his credit card to spend all sorts of his own money on campaign activity. Now, the rules are a little bit different for credit card spending. You have 60 days to pay the credit card bill, and if you do, it doesn't count. That raises two issues. First, it seems to me that could you take out the American Express Platinum card and run up all sorts of personal spending and then essentially buy yourself 60 days worth of funding your own campaign once you had matching funds? To me, that's a much more serious problem and a much more troubling potential loophole than the situation that is presented before us. And two, Buchanan was not forced to repay his matching funds. So the commission considered the issue where you had a candidate who already had the taxpayer money, but yet broke the $50,000 cap. And there's no question that he did, because in a subsequent murder, he was fined, or at least agreed to pay a penalty of $15,000 for that violation. But that did not require a repayment. It doesn't make sense to me that a person who's already taken the matching funds, and I note that actually the Buchanan matter is not referenced in anyone's briefs. This is something that we had to dig up here on our own, and it was actually, I had to dig through the audit records and to find this. It doesn't make any sense to me that someone could take the taxpayer money and then break the cap, but yet, simply because they went over $50,000, would not even be entitled to take the taxpayer money when, in the Buchanan situation, he didn't have to repay the money. More recently, it seems the Commission has taken a more permissive approach to public financing in general. Again, I applaud the efforts of prior commissioners in doing this because I think it tries to make the system work. And regardless whether one agrees or disagrees with public funding, it is what's on the books, so we have to do the best we can. And what I'm thinking about in large part is up until recently, if you ran for president, you could not raise money for the general election. Because if you did raise money for the general election, you essentially gave up your ability to qualify for the taxpayer money for the general. Well, then Senator Obama asked for an advisory opinion, and this commission, in a 5-0 opinion, said that, well, no, actually you could raise the general election money. You do not have to make the choice so soon. You can raise the money, keep it off in an account, and when the time is right, you can then make the decision whether or not you're going to use the taxpayer money. If you take the taxpayer money, you have to give the money back, and the AO lays out certain criteria and that sort of thing. But the general proposition there is that the commission did allow for the decision to be made much later than what had been historically been considered the time to make the decision. That applies here, I think, because we have a situation where a candidate needs seed money, spends his own money, which just like the public financing is also the sort of money that at least the Supreme Court considers to be clean money, and it's a constitutional right to spend your own money. We're not talking about contributions from others. We're talking about money out of his own pocket. Spend the money, and by doing so, he has essentially made the choice to not take matching funds or not even be able to be eligible. It seems to me that he shouldn't have to make the choice so soon. One passage in the council's brief that talks about, well, this would reward him for not educating himself on making on all the options available to him. Well, that's not really the purpose of the law. It's not to punish people who are unable to make a decision, and it's not that he couldn't make a decision, but let's take a step back and think about the situation where you have a candidate, perhaps a third-party candidate or a candidate who maybe is a party candidate but is not considered the front-runner, so who knows if they're going to have sufficient private fundraising options, or who knows if they're going to be, to a degree which even allow them to qualify for the matching funds. Really, one of the only choices a candidate such as Senator Gravel may have is to self-fund, and when he self-funds, he can get going, and then once he gets going, maybe he will have enough support from private money to qualify for the matching funds. But to say he's ineligible for matching funds the moment he crosses the $50,000 threshold seems to me that we're forcing him to make a choice. And unfortunately, it's not a simple choice. It's a complicated choice because it involves giving up a constitutional right. As we know, the Buckley Court said self-funding is a constitutional right. You can check that at the door, so to speak, when you take the matching funds. But that's once you get into the program. You can't really punish somebody for not being willing to give up a constitutional right because they simply didn't know all the nuances of the matching funds regime. Moreover, a more recent Supreme Court case, FEC versus Davis, dealt with the millionaire provision. The millionaire provision, of course, said you could self-fund, but if you did, your opponent could raise additional money. The Supreme Court struck that down, not because of the floating contribution limit, which is what most said that would be the issue, but really on a grounds that most said the court would skip over, which was the chilling of the First Amendment right of the person who wanted to self-fund. So post-Davis, I read this situation where you cannot force a candidate to make a decision before they need to make a decision, and to adopt the council recommendation would require a candidate to decide whether or not they wanted to be eligible for matching funds someday long down the road at a time where they couldn't possibly know if they could qualify for matching funds, at the same time giving up their First Amendment right to self-fund. If that doesn't, if all these arguments don't work, we could decide this on a much more narrow ground, and that's on the facts. Under 9033.3, the commission, and I think it's to read the reg, it says, if the commission makes an initial determination that a candidate or the candidate's authorized committee have knowingly and substantially exceeded the expenditure limitations, et cetera, et cetera, then we may make an initial determination that the candidate is ineligible to receive matching funds. So it seems like a discretionary decision by the commission, because it says that the commission makes an initial determination, so it's something we can do. And then it has these terms, knowingly and substantially. Whether he knowingly did it or not, I think there's probably room to debate. I don't think, it depends how you define knowingly. He obviously, to me, did not know that he was giving up his opportunity to be eligible for matching funds or causing him or causing himself problems down the road. But then we get into whether or not knowledge of the law is what it means by knowingly, or is this knowingly more along the concept of, did you know you accepted an in-kind contribution? And it doesn't really, it's not knowledge of the law, it's knowledge of the facts, and he knew he was spending the money, so maybe he did knowingly spend the money. I don't think we need to decide that issue. I think we can hang our hat on the word substantially. Here we have $23,000 over the limit. The question is that substantial? I guess if you do it as a percentage of the $50,000 threshold, you could say, well, it's almost half, so that must be substantial. But substantial is a relative term, and it's a fact, it's a question of fact, which we can decide that $23,000 over the limit is not substantial, and I think that's easy to do for a variety of reasons. $50,000 threshold is quite low. It is the statutory threshold. It's not indexed for inflation, but what it means to be substantial is essentially, I think, something that needs to be compared to modern norms. Given the amount of money that modern campaigns spend, I don't think anyone, when compared to that amount, could say that $23,000 is a substantial amount of money. Moreover, I actually went to the trouble of looking at the Department of Labor. They have a website where they actually allow you to put in a dollar amount, put in the year, and see what that dollar amount would be today. $23,000 then, when the law was passed, and the reg was put on the books, supposedly, I would suppose, is well over $100,000 today. In fact, $50,000 today is like $220,000 in real dollars. So $23,000 compared to all the spending, to me, is not substantial. So to me, in addition to all my fancy arguments about the Constitution and whether the reg is consistent with the statute, to me, we can actually decide this on a narrow ground to say that the $23,000 was not substantial. Moreover, he came back under the $50,000 when he applied, which I think we can read the reg and the statute to mean that's the critical day. And moreover, we have the Buchanan situation where Buchanan clearly went over the $50,000 threshold and did not have to make a repayment of the matching funds. So someone who took the matching funds and certified that they were not going to break the $50,000 cap and did doesn't have to give the taxpayer money back. It seems to me that Senator Gravel, who went over it by not a lot of money, in my view, and went to the trouble of getting back under that view, is entitled to the same treatment. So that's where I am. I don't know if that's persuaded anyone else, but anyone else has any comments, happy to recognize them.
Mr. Peterson, I had a question on them.
Sure.
Let me ask you your thoughts on this Buchanan thing, since that was new to me too until yesterday. How you perceive that? I think what bothers me is somebody comes beforehand and cures, basically, and then. But if they do it afterward, after they've certified, after you know everything, if it's clear what they've already said, they've read it and everything else, then they do it, and the consequences aren't disqualifying. It's a fine, and it just seemed to me to be unequal treatment. If somebody comes along and does it and basically cures it, if it's very aggravated, in a major way, and we know from previous examples how it can get aggravated, but basically comes back and cures the thing, how does that square? Because I know there was a number of, I'm not for the consequence that somebody can go out and, at this point, thinking it through, go out and loan indiscriminate amounts and then pay it all back and then apply, but this is fairly akin to Buchanan, except for the timing.
This is different from Buchanan because in this situation, we're looking at the question of eligibility and whether they should be eligible at all. He has to certify that he won't exceed the personal expenditure limitation. If he's already exceeded the personal expenditure limitation, he can't be eligible. So it is more like Sharpton, where Sharpton had to repay the entire amount of matching funds he received because he was never eligible because he had gone over the personal expenditure limitation when he applied. That's the same situation here. In Buchanan, the candidate was eligible, he received matching funds, and then he went over one of the limitations. We've had a lot of audits where candidates have gone over the various different limitations, the state limitation, the overall limitation. For the state and overall limitation, ordinarily what happens is there's a repayment based on non-qualified campaign expenses for going over those expenditure limitations. For the personal expenditure limitation in Buchanan, because it wasn't a question of non-qualified campaign expenses, it wasn't a repayment matter, it was referred to for a compliance matter in MER 5045, and then that was resolved with a conciliation agreement. But basically the distinction is that it's the timing of it. Here, we're looking at whether he should be eligible at all, whereas in other audits, it's a question of, okay, now you've exceeded this limit, even though you had agreed not to. We don't ask them to give back all their matching funds, but we do have repercussions from that, either a repayment or a compliance matter, or in some cases, both.
I would just add to that in the Buchanan matter, as I'm given to understand it, we didn't know at the time that he went over that he had actually gone over. We did not find out that Mr. Buchanan had gone over the personal expenditure limit until the post-campaign audit, and there's very little we can do about it until we actually know about it. If there's a situation in which a candidate is eligible and really has not gone over the limit at the time they apply, and the commission certifies them as eligible and they get the public funds, and then we find out about it while we're still in the payment period, we've got the authority under, I think it's 11 CFR 9033.9, is that right, to turn the spigot off.
And I haven't tried to study it, but I saw that in some of the regs you can suspend.
Right, that's the right. Suspension.
But then what happens when you suspend, it doesn't mean you, I got the impression there's a repayment remedy available at that point as well.
Well, if,
is that correct? I mean, I have not tried to learn these, unfortunately, because it kind of came to me late and I just was trying to get the hang of it. But
the suspension rule is for where the commission finds out that a candidate, after they've been determined eligible, finds out that they've exceeded one of the expenditure limitations.
Right.
So, for example, the overall expenditure limitation is around $45 million. And if the commission were to find out that someone had spent $100 million on their campaign, they could say, okay, well, there's no way that you can be under the limit, so we're going to turn off your matching funds. And then they wouldn't get any more matching funds. Then there would be an audit to determine whether there should be any additional repayment.
Hmm. So is there any ability to suspend? Suspend means different than terminate, because suspend means you're going to hold something in abeyance. So a situation can occur. I mean, that's a very exaggerated one, but if it's $45 million and you find out it's 46, you suspend, and then what happens?
For 46, because there's so many, like for the overall expenditure limitation, there's so many exemptions and other things and the calculations of it that it might be possible that they are still under the limit. So if it was something where it was extreme, where they were substantially over the limit, the commission could suspend the funds. I think the term is suspend because they do have the opportunity to come back to us and prove that they haven't gone over the limit, and then they get the money.
I would add to that, and Mr. Holloway was reminding me of what I was just thinking of, that although it does use the word suspend in both of the operative parts of that regulation, it actually, if you look at the whole regulation, depends on why you are suspending the payment of matching funds. There are two reasons you can suspend the payment of matching funds to an eligible candidate. One is that they haven't filed their disclosure reports, and one is that they've exceeded the expenditure limit. If they haven't filed their disclosure reports, you can turn the spigot back on once they file their disclosure reports. If they go over the expenditure limit, the language of the regulation, even though it says suspend, it basically says the candidate may not then thereafter come in and demonstrate that they have fixed the problem. In other words, it's a termination of the entitlement.
They can only show that they didn't go over the limit, but they can't fix it.
Then there was another reg here that I was just trying to get going through the regs. The one reg is 9035.2, says no candidate who has accepted matching funds shall knowingly make expenditures from his or her personal funds. Does that mean that this particular reg is a prospective one only? And is there any change in our interpretation because substantially is not a part of that? And the word willfully was quoted earlier as being a requirement as well. So I'm curious, how can we pin down when it has to be knowing, when it has to be willful, when it has to be substantial, and how we determine what a substantial is?
Well, let us take that in several parts.
Because substantial to me could mean not just the amount that, is it substantial in terms of what you would otherwise be entitled, mm-hmm. or substantial just because of the amount of loan? Somebody loans $10,000 and it's $5,000 over, is that substantial because it's 50% more?
It could.
I mean, I don't know.
Let me deal with the easy one first. On willful, Ms. Painter was quoting from the 1979 ENJ that says knowingly, willfully, and substantially. The word willful actually was put in the reg in 1979. It was dropped from the reg in 1983. So we're not concerning ourselves with willful. On substantial, it's true that regulation says knowingly and substantially, and the commission hasn't done anything to further define substantially. The way in our draft initial statement we looked at it was that it was from the perspective of the percentage of the limit itself. It seemed to us that exceeding the limit by nearly half again the size of the limit was a substantial exceeding of the limit, but that ultimately is a question for the commission to decide.
Let me ask you a couple of questions too on the testing the waters. When I first started to think about this, and the candidates raise huge amounts of money in theory, and not in today's terms, it's a lot of money. It's a lot more than $50,000 to test the waters. And I don't know the regs as well as it could be, but we have a situation in which a candidate can raise a lot of money by testing the waters when, in fact, you're kind of on the border when you become a candidate, and then once you do, things kick in. But then when can you take matching funds if you've done that with that money?
The testing the waters would be expenses by his campaign, so the $50,000 limit wouldn't apply to that unless it was his personal funds. But in several audits, several election cycles before, when you start to campaign, all the regular limits kick in as if it's all been part of your campaign. And I believe in the Dolan Kemp campaigns back in 1988, there were some testing the water expenses that were ultimately counted against their expenditure limitations.
In this particular case, if somebody spends $60,000 of their own money to test the waters, they have other money that comes in as well. Does that automatically disqualify them now from federal matching funds?
$60,000?
Yes.
Yes. How come there was a time that it didn't?
I'm not sure that I know the answer to that question other than that the commission did decide to change that regulation. As for matching funds specifically, you had mentioned, Mr. Chairman, in your statement, and we had dropped a footnote into our supplemental memorandum about the Curry advisory opinion. And there was a time at which candidates could otherwise take prohibited money and spend that to test the waters, and that would be a Title II provision, not just a public financing provision, so long as they gave it back within 10 days. And in the Curry AO, as I understand it, the commission decided, well, if we've got this provision in our regulations that says that you could even take prohibited money to test the waters as long as you gave it back within 10 days, you can sure take your own, spend more than the limit of your own money to test the waters as long as you pay it back within 10 days. Subsequently, the testing of waters regulations were changed to say, no, if you take prohibited money to test the waters, whatever happens to you if you decide not to get in the race, if you do get in the race, that adverts back to the day you started to test the waters, and you've effectively taken a prohibited contribution. So the regulation that the Curry opinion was analogizing to has itself been stricken from the books.
Right, I understand that. I mentioned that in my comments, but the significance of it is I see a situation where you could go over the $50,000 cap, come back under it, if you came back under it in time, and still get the matching funds. Okay, so I'm talking more just as a broader policy matter. When I read your brief, there's a lot of language about, well, the potential for loopholes and you can that kind of thing, and that's my words, not yours. I don't want to mischaracterize your brief, but the notion that somebody could self-fund to the umpteenth degree and then somehow still get matching funds would cause this massive unequal playing field, okay, which I don't think really post Buckley is a viable reason, but let's say it is. I'll play on the equal speech field. If that's the case, then how come somebody could do that back when the matching funds, when the testing the waters rules were different? You could even have prohibited money and go over the $50,000. Somebody who takes the matching funds is allowed to go over the limit and pay a penalty, not have to do a repayment. I'm referring obviously to Buchanan. Taking it more in the abstract, someone who has already received taxpayer money, and to me it seems to me that once you certify you're not going to do something, it's important you don't do it. But there's even a loophole there, right? Because you could spend your own money on a credit card, and so long as you pay it within 60 days of getting the bill, that's okay. So the idea that there's a loophole that someone could self-fund and then at the last minute sneak under the $50,000 threshold, to me, is swallowed by other rules, because if someone could get the matching funds and then take, like I said, the Platinum Amex card and run up a couple $100,000 worth of expenses, that seems to me to blow a hole in the side of the equal speech boat so big it sinks to the bottom. And then we have our friend, the Obama AO, where, again, we get into the timing issue, right? He did not have to make this catch-22 choice early. He was allowed to wait. And I saw that as an effort to try to keep the public financing system working, because if people are forced to make a choice early, it's not good for the system. And to me, that's worse. And I think, listening to the vice chair's comments, it seems to me that is much more, policy driven. Then you get into what really is substantial. Are we really going to sit here today and say $23,000 is a substantial amount of money? If that's the case, then when we start to fine people, is that going to be deemed substantial? I don't think that's deemed substantial anymore in any sort of political world. Given particularly how much do you get in matching funds, is even those the larger candidates who can do more of a match. I mean, it's astronomical sums of money here, and it just seems to me that there's so much else to the story than a simple, well, we need to level the playing field, and if somebody breaks the $50,000 cap, it's the whole apple cart's upset. It's $23,000, right? It's not like there's some unfair advantage. I'm having real trouble squaring all these other examples where someone, for various reasons, is able to go over the $50,000 threshold and come back under it. But in this case, this person's not able to do that. And I understand that you can draw the distinction between whether you're eligible and then once you're eligible. But to me, once you're eligible, it's even worse to let somebody to go float over the $50,000 and come back while taking the taxpayer money. It seems to me this is a much easier case than the cases I've cited. What am I missing here?
Well, I think about Buchanan, there are a couple of things. First, as I had mentioned, Buchanan was in a position in which we really did not know what had happened in Buchanan until after the horse was long since out of the barn, and so.
But even with that, couldn't there be a repayment of the funds? I mean, he certified he wasn't going to do something, right? He didn't keep that promise. Wouldn't that then? Couldn't the commission then have said, you must repay your matching funds?
My understanding of this, and Ms. Painter and Mr. Holloway may be able to help me with this, is that what we can seek repayment for are for the use of public funds on non-qualified campaign expenses. And while there has been some argument over this question in some context, our view has generally been that when you exceed the state-by-state or overall spending limits, that is, under the statute and regs, a non-qualified campaign expense. And I don't think that reasoning has been extended to in-kind spending on behalf of one's own campaign in excess of the $50,000 personal funds limit.
It certainly hasn't been extended to that. We know it hasn't because of the Buchanan case. Right? The question is answered. It's not an open question. Is there anything out there that helps us define what substantially means as it's used in 9033.3?
The only thing that's coming immediately to mind is the Sharpton audit. In the Sharpton audit, we certified Reverend Sharpton eligible for public money because while there was some thought that he might, even at the time we certified him, that he might have exceeded the limit. We didn't have the lead pipe evidence in hand. So the commission certified him as eligible and at the same time initiated a 9039 investigation to determine the facts. Upon determination of the facts, the commission determined that he had already exceeded the expenditure limit as of the time he applied. In that instance, the commission determined that he had never actually been eligible in the first place and told him and did not wait for the audit. The commission told him you were never eligible in the first place and you have to give 100% of the money back and you have to give it back now. And he did. What the commission did in, there are a couple of things about that determination that I think are kind of instructive for this matter. First of all, the commission obviously looked retrospectively at the payments that Reverend Sharpton had made on his Amex card for his own campaign. If it was looking only prospectively, then actually he would have been eligible and wouldn't have been able to make the same determination that we did because the money that he had paid on the Amex card prior to applying for matching funds wouldn't have counted. Secondly, he exceeded the personal spending limit there by $66,000, which means that it was a little more than twice, the amount of the excess was a little more than twice the limit. So by implication, the commission decided that $66,000 were on a percentage basis, a little bit more than twice the limit, was substantial. So if you were to decide this matter on the basis that the amount by which Senator Gravel went over wasn't substantial, you'd essentially be saying that either half again the limit or $24,000 isn't substantial, but a little more than twice the limit or $66,000 is substantial.
But we could do that.
You could do that,
right? I mean, it's a judgment call, and we could, and that would be a narrow ground that wouldn't do violence to the whole regime or open up loopholes or any of this other kind of stuff that some may say, right? Essentially a factual determination that in this case, on these facts, that's not something that's substantial, and in the other case it was. Now, I thought though with Sharpton that when Sharpton applied, it was clear he was over the $50,000.
In Sharpton, the commission determined ultimately that he was definitely over the $50,000 when he applied.
Right.
But at the time that he did apply, we only had his reports to go on, and it was a very close number. So what the commission did was initiated a 9039 investigation to go out and look at his credit card receipts and his other payments and to find out how much, and then the commission determined $66,000 was, as of the time the commission made the repayment determination, the commission determined that it was $66,000 over.
But the commission did determine that it was over 50 at the time. Here, though, we're certain, at least as certain as we're going to be, that it's at the time he applied, it was less than, he had less than $50,000. And we know he had got the 73, but he had paid off over 23 grand, and we know to metaphysical certainty that he was less than 50.
That's right. It's a question of the what, if any, is the legal effect of the repayment. Unlike in Sharpton, where we had some doubt as to the facts at the time the commission had to actually act on the application, there's no factual dispute here.
Okay.
Let me ask a hypothetical, if I could. If there's a couple of things that are concerning to me. One is how you can get the benefit, if I understand it right, of going over the limit if you just charge the money. If you have a credit card, if you go borrow from somebody, I don't know if it's a difference if you borrow somebody, but if you could, and certainly with American Express, you could borrow a couple hundred thousand dollars, and I'm not sure, okay, it's over, it's a credit card, that's probably substantial, but then it's okay if somebody borrows $25,000 from themselves or and goes over, then it's not. And there's a disparity in basically how the money is used. And I'm wondering what has been the policy of the commission for drawing that disparity, if I'm correct in the way my hypothetical works.
There's a regulation in governing the credit cards.
I understand.
And it basically is based on when it's reimbursed and whether it's reimbursed timely.
Mm-hmm. I recognize that, but what's the reason for making an exception from somebody who goes to American Express and gets the money as opposed to going to a spouse or his or her own bank account? What's the policy reason for it?
I'd have to say, frankly, I'm not sure.
Okay, pardon me.
If I might.
I see what you're saying, but nevertheless.
That rule came out of some cases where candidates used their credit cards, and the argument was made that until the bill was due, they hadn't really expended the funds and shouldn't charge the limitation. Whether that's a good argument or not, it was accepted at the time and incorporated into the regulation. And so that time was given before the presumably candidate would need to pay the bill, and the allowance was made for business cycle on the billing process.
So when you use the credit card, I guess the candidate probably bought things, stuff. They probably got the stuff
that
in
was
hand.
Generally
they used
the
stuff, but typically
travel.
Yeah. So they got the benefit of extending their own.
But the argument was made that it shouldn't count until the bill was due, and the commission at the time agreed.
But as a policy matter, then how can we turn back on? I mean, it seems to me as a sense of sort of equality. If you allow it for credit cards, why is what happened here a problem? Seems to me to be a very similar sort of policy dynamic.
Well, I think on the credit cards, we just make two points. One is simply that we have a regulation about credit cards that tells us to. And secondly, that based precisely on, as Mr. Stoltz said, the timing of the credit card billing cycle, there's a 60-day limit for the reimbursement or repayment in that regulation, and the repayments here were outside 60 days.
What, go on the hypothetical, if Buchanan, if in this particular case the loan was made afterward, what would be the recommend? Say the person, Gravel goes all the way, gets all the money, and then you find out that he'd been over $23,000. What would be your recommendation at that point?
So the loan was made after he became eligible?
Right, after he's certified in writing, after the regs are all clear at that point, it's prospective, likely it's knowing and willful and everything else, then what would you do? What would be the recommendation?
Well, the commission, it depends when the commission would find out about it, but ordinarily we'd find out about something like that in the audit context. There'd be an audit finding, they'd have a chance to respond to it, and then for personal expenditure limitation, it could be something that would be referred, like in Buchanan.
if we found out about it prior to that time, if we found out about it during the campaign itself, I think our recommendation would be to take away his entitlement to any further public money.
Regardless of the amount, or if it's only substantial at that point?
If it wasn't substantial, it would have to be, I think, a knowing and substantial. It would have to be substantial and knowing.
But would we measure substantial?
We would recommend turning off.
If we would measure substantial at that point in terms of how much overall public money the person got, it was a couple $1 million and it was $25,000 over, what would the commission do? I have a hunch I know what the commission would do. They probably wouldn't make them come bring that money back.
Assuming that we were talking about the $50,000 personal expenditure limit, not one of the other expenditure limits, and it was $25,000 over, I think our recommendation would be the same as it is here.
You have to pay back a couple $1 million?
You wouldn't have to give back all the money they'd ever received. They'd have to suspend their future
public money.
They wouldn't get any more.
Yeah, because it wouldn't make them not eligible, whereas here he was never eligible because he didn't meet the requirements. But there, he would have been eligible for some amount of time. Then we would suspend the payments. He couldn't get any more matching funds.
But really what it amounts to and the law always is what it is, but what it amounts to is somebody who can secrete the transaction and sign the certification and clearly know what the law is. As long as the money is all obtained from public funding, the remedy would be less than if the person was upfront honest and say, hey, I went over 23, but I repaid it back. I still want to qualify.
Well, I think the timing.
Trying to get it figured in how.
I think the timing of it would matter, because if we found out that someone had gotten a loan before they applied for matching funds, then we'd be in the same situation as here, and we'd probably want to get all the money back like we did in Sharpton. So really the timing of when they go over the expenditure limitation does make a difference in how it's treated.
Sorry, go ahead.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the chairman's creativity and diligence in this matter. But for me, it's actually a pretty simple question, because we have a reg on the books that looks pretty straightforward to me. And a lot of the questions seem to go to, well, why do our regs allow this and not that? You know, what's the underlying policy behind it? And those are valid questions to ask in a rulemaking context, you know, if we wanted to think about repealing or changing some of our rules to try and make them more consistent with an overall framework as we saw it, if we think they're inconsistent now. But the reality is we've got a statutory provision that's been on the book for decades. It's been upheld by the Supreme Court. And it was upheld by the same Supreme Court in the same opinion that said that you have a constitutional right to spend your own personal money. So, you know, they were aware of that at the time. We have a regulation that's been on the book for decades and has not been challenged. Am I right about that? Never been challenged?
It's the first time the issue's come up, though.
This is the first time the issue of a repayment to get back under the $50,000 limit has come up. This 9033 has never been challenged.
And the regulation says, you know, have not incurred and will not incur. And I think the plain meaning of have not, I have not incurred this is not, you know, I have not incurred this as of this moment in time, but I have not incurred this in the past. I think that's just to me, that's what the plain meaning of the words mean. One can argue that $23,000 is not substantial. One can argue that $50,000 is not substantial, that this was set in an earlier era when campaigns were a lot less expensive. And maybe they should have put in an inflation adjuster. But as we know, Congress put inflation adjustments in some provisions of the law and not in others. And even most recently, they put an inflation adjustment in the contribution limit, but not in the PAC limit. You know, why did they do that? I don't know why they did that, but that's what the statute does. And I don't think we're in a position to infer an inflation adjustment in there. And when you look at the number that the statute says is significant, $50,000, seems to me an extra $23,000 on top of that is a substantial increase. I don't I understand the impetus to try and help the candidate out, but I just think the regulations are pretty clear on their face and don't really leave us nearly the leeway that that the chairman seems to think that they do. So, you know, for me, I agree with counsel on this.
If I could, you raise, I understand the argument. But my initial thought is that argument can't have it both ways. You can't on the one hand invoke the statute to say, well, $50,000 is the amount, and then say that, well, the reg says it's have not incurred, which is therefore in the past, while at the same time sidestepping fact that the statute, if we want to talk clear, the statute says to be eligible to receive payments under section 9037, a candidate shall certify to the commission that the candidate and his authorized committee will not incur qualified campaign expenses. So the reg rewrote the statute. If we stick with this sort of argument, if it really is to apply before the date that the candidate certifies. Because it will not incur, I think we agree, is future, right? There is no language in the statute about have not incurred. That's a complete creature of the regulation. The statute says $50,000, and I'm going to undercut my own argument here about this substantially. Statute doesn't say anything about a little bit over 50 grand. It says 50 grand, but yet the reg says knowingly and substantially. So through reg, we have created a floating standard. And we have said that if the commission, we put it within our discretion. And if we're going to take the position the reg on the book is the reg on the book, then let's take the reg on the book. And the reg on the book says whether if he's knowingly and substantially exceeded, which means the commission has made a decision there in a rulemaking that you can exceed $50,000 yet still qualify for matching funds. And if that's the case, it then is squarely within our decision-making ability to decide what substantially means. It doesn't require congressional indexing of the $50,000 limit. That issue has come and gone through this rulemaking. So under this rule, it does allow us to decide what is substantial. If $23,000 is substantial, what is not substantial? We could go back and forth, and I could say, is $50,001 substantial? Probably not, right? We agree on that. But at some point, where is the line between insubstantial or okay, we can give him the matching funds, and substantial? It's a standard that to me is a factual standard, and to me I look at it as one that can be compared to something. It has to be. You can't say something is substantial in a vacuum. It has to be compared to something. If you compare it to the $50,000 limit, that's only one way to do it. I think there's other ways to do it. And I think modern reality is $23,000 just isn't a substantial amount, particularly here where he went back under the $50,000. He was able to repay it, right? So it's not so substantial that he wasn't able to get under there.
We're gonna come back and switch arguments when we're in executive session the next time we're looking at a penalty, as you alluded to earlier. And I'm gonna remind you that $23,000 is, according to you, a very insubstantial amount. And I suspect we'll be on different sides on that one. But you know,
we can both claim we did a substantial penalty, and whatever we did, an orange is an orange unless we, you know, or one of, you know, I guess it's not the same color because. You know, everybody can say what substantial is, I guess, in their own way. And in this sort of case, without some really egregious problem, policy-wise, something that's going to cause problems, on these facts, I don't see it as substantial. What I'm saying is we don't have to decide on all this fancy stuff I came up with, First Amendment and all this statutory language and Chevron and all this nice creative stuff that you could it's not really creative, it's actually Supreme Court precedent. We can just decide it on our own regs and it's really what is substantial. And maybe 23 grand is substantial in this context to some, but ultimately it's who knows, right? Now, he's already spent his money, okay? Now we're here today deciding whether he did was okay after the fact, and we get to sort of decide whether or not it was substantial. When somebody's sitting there deciding, I wonder if $55,000 is substantial. I wonder if $60,000 is substantial. There's no way for them to know that, right? It's a complete after the fact decision maker, and particularly in this case, right? He spent things on credit card. You can imagine him, you know, traveling around and going to the ticket counter or going online now, right? Because it's modern. We're not. When the law was passed, we all do it online, and saying, oh, wait a second, this ticket may be put me substantially over the $50,000. I'm not sure if I can. I mean, at some point, there's got to be some fluidity, he's completely at our mercy as to deciding after the fact what is substantial and what is not substantial, when there's a lot of arguments that you could see, I think, depending how you define substantial, $23,000 may not be substantial in some context.
I respect that you don't find $23,000 to be substantial in this context. Personally, when I look at that provision of the statute and the regulations, I have to compare it against $50,000, mm-hmm. which is the provision that we're looking at. And to me, I think it is substantial in the context. I respect that you're in a different place, but that's just
the way I look at it. We agree it's a fact determination.
It's a fact, right. And there might be a case that would be difficult and close and that, you know, I would struggle with, but this one isn't it.
What about the statute where it says will not incur, but the reg put tax on this have not incurred? Can we do that?
Well, I think
I know the reg's on the books, but
I think we would say three things about that, the prospectivity argument. The first is that you had mentioned a concern about results, I think, in your statement, Mr. Chairman, or at least about you wouldn't go so far as to reach an absurd result. And I think we do have some concern about that. The particular statute at issue says that the candidate has to certify that he will not exceed any of the expenditure limits in 9035. If you look at 9035, that's all of them. 9035 refers to the expenditure limits of 441AB, which are the overall and state-by-state limits, and imposes the $50,000 personal funds expenditure limit. So we're having a hard time finding a way that you read that if you're going to say that 9033 is prospective, but it's not purely prospective with respect to all of them. And that could get you to a spot where you could run a campaign as large as Senator Obama's and come in convention week and say, I will not, I'm seeking matching funds, and I'm certifying that I will not exceed from this point forward an overall limit of $45 million or whatever it is, and you could have yourself a pretty good convention week on that. The second thing I think that we would say about it is
is there any chance of that happening here?
Probably little chance,
okay.
But there is, and certainly not in this case, but it would be a reading and statute that would open that up. The second thing I think that we would say about it is, and this is, I haven't had the chance to make this argument at this table, but I believe some of my colleagues have, is that, as you said, Mr. Chairman, the regulation is on the books, and the black letter law that we understand here is that the commission or any government agency, any administrative agency, is required to follow its own regulations. If it thinks that one of its own regulations may not be consistent or may go beyond what Congress has permitted it to do by statute, it should, assuming that decision hasn't been made by some higher authority, like Congress in the form of intervening legislation or by a court, the proper thing for an administrative agency to do in that situation is, in an individual case, to follow its own regulation and to explore changing the regulation in a notice and comment rulemaking. And then finally,
Hang on. Would you be suggesting if in the hypothetical, a reg is different than the statute, we'd be obligated to read the reg even though we knew it was inconsistent with the statute? If I, sitting here as a commissioner, saw a statute that said one thing and the reg said something more than or less than maybe, okay, but more than the statute, I'd be obligated to follow the reg even though I know it's inconsistent with the statute? And in my view, the statute spoke to the issue directly, a la Chevron?
Well, I would simply say that I think that the rule of the black letter is that agencies generally, and when engaging in case-by-case adjudication, should presume the regularity of their own regulations. We have, in fact, lost a case, at least one, because. At least in the court's view, it wasn't our view at the time, but in the court's view, we were not following our own regulations. In Ray Seal case, we of course, as I know you know, Mr. Chairman, and many here may know, we used to have a practice of, in enforcement matters, 437G confidentiality was absolute unless we had to sue to enforce a subpoena, and then we would file that suit in open court. And a case about that went to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit said that among the other reasons that practice was not permissible was that it was in contravention of our own regulations on the confidentiality of enforcement matters. We have lost cases before where courts have said, well, you've got a regulation right here and you didn't follow it. The last thing
you've also, though, had the flip side, right, where we've lost cases where the court said the statute was clear and the reg went beyond what the statute.
We have.
Recently, actually.
But yeah. But that would be in this view, that's something that courts can say. And that's one of the risks you run. The last thing I would say,
just on that point. I mean, we really are in a different position from a court. A court can tell the agency, your reg is no good. But for sitting here as administrators, we can't ignore our own regulations, our own lawfully promulgated regulations. We are not a court.
And I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting reading the reg to be consistent with the statute, not inconsistent with the statute. I mean, I'm not saying throw out the reg, but I'm saying I read it as inconsistent, or I see your reading as inconsistent with the statute. I have a reading that I think is consistent with the statute. It really gets on the temporal issue, and reading it that way, we could do that, right?
Well, the Commission Z&J, when it promulgated the regulation, said that they intended to apply the rules retrospectively, that they thought that it would basically undermine the statute and the purpose of these expenditure limitations to allow people to do something like make all these expenditures and then come in and have to be eligible and not count those previous expenditures.
So our view is the reg does say that we can't allow someone to break the $50,000 cap in the rearview mirror, right, before they certify, right? That's what the reg says. It's not saying what I say.
That we can not.
Once you break the $50,000 cap, right, and just set aside the substantial, let's say it's that's it.
Right.
Okay. Now square that, please, with the notion that someone, when doing testing the waters, can break the cap, and that happened post this reg, right, and come back under the cap. Isn't that inconsistent with that reading of the reg? Hasn't the AO supported my reading?
I think it's inconsistent, and I don't think that the AO would be decided the same way today.
Okay, so we're moving around here in how we read things. It's not always right. It hasn't been consistent. We have some inconsistency here on these regs that are on the books. Sometimes that happens. Things are not always done the same way.
The commission can change regulations as it did with the reg. It can engage in rulemaking that changes its regulations.
Well, an AO is not in the reg, right? It's an interpretation of presumably a reg. So we could change
correct,
our interpretation
but it,
of
but
reg.
But it was an analogy to a regulation.
Okay.
And the regulation that was analogized to was changed.
Okay.
The last thing I'd say, to come down to the micro level a little bit, and I think I did mention this before, just on prospectivity versus retrospectivity, is that if we were to read the regulation as being fully prospective, we would reach an outcome that would be inconsistent with what the determination was with respect to Reverend Sharpton.
Okay, we just disagree on that. I think we can distinguish them. That one question I have, and this is really, I'm not sure this persuades anyone else at the table, but I'm curious, does FEC versus Davis have any application here at all? Is there any teaching from that case that may apply here?
I think I'd put it this way. I don't think that Davis said that you can never have any difference between self-funded and non-self-funded candidates. What it said was that you cannot, absent of a sufficient state interest, and I'm not stating that standard precisely, I know, subject the self-funded candidate to a discriminatory regulatory regime just because he exercises his First Amendment right to self-fund. What you can do, what you have been able to do since Buckley, what Congress has done since Buckley, is to condition the receipt of a public benefit like money, or the eligibility for that benefit, on making a choice between keeping in full your First Amendment right to self-fund, or choosing to take the public benefit. And I would point out that while, as we discussed a couple of months ago in the McCain matter, although there may be some uncertainty about precisely where the line is, until you actually get the public benefit, you can change your mind and get out. So there is
that
safety valve.
But that's my point. Okay, let's talk about this particular case. Senator Gravel spends his own money. He doesn't know if he's going to take matching funds or not, because he needs the money, his own money, as seed money to get going. If he decides not to spend that money, he certainly is never going to get going as a candidate, and he'll never qualify for the matching funds. He needs the seed money to get going, presumably, in order to get on the radar screen of people who may give him enough money that would allow him to qualify for the matching funds. You have him in this circular logic that, of course, is going to add up, because circular logic always does connect. That's why it's circular. Okay, so you are forcing a choice on this guy, to me, very similar to the choice, at least in the abstract, that the court confronted in Davis. So, I take the answer to my question as a yes. Davis does have some teaching here, or is that a no?
I'm not sure we're drawing the same. There may be some teaching from Davis here, but I'm not sure we're drawing the same teaching.
Okay. But we do agree, though, do we not, that he, or candidates similarly situated to Gravel, have to make a choice long before they receive the public benefit. As you said, that's, you referenced the McCain matter, it was at the time the person would receive the public. You draw significance as to the timing when you receive the benefit.
Yes.
So he has to decide, or candidates like him have to decide, long before they're even close to being eligible to receive this public benefit, whether or not they're going to spend their own money, which is a constitutional right, and they have to give up that constitutional right in the abstract, hoping that they can raise enough to qualify for the matching funds, when they would otherwise not be able to build a fundraising list or travel or get any sort of good buzz. So I'm caught in this circle here.
I think that's right. I think that is the choice that they do have to make. And my point on McCain was that is not a choice that, once they get in the system, it's not a choice that is irrevocable on their part. But they do have to, as you would with pretty much any federal entitlement program, you've got to maintain yourself in a state of eligibility to apply for the program and get into it in the first place.
Did I hear you say, though, it's a choice that's not irrevocable?
It's a choice that, the choice to spend the money,
right,
would be, if you go over that limit, that would be a bell that can't be unrung.
Unless it's substantial. We can go over the statutory. We've established that.
Unless it's substantial.
Right. Which is something that's decided when? At the time you spend the money or after the fact by the government?
It would be decided when you apply for matching funds.
After you've already decided to spend.
That's right.
At a time when you have no idea whether you'd even be close to being eligible.
The one safety valve to that is that if after you are deemed eligible and before you've received a public benefit, then you change your mind, you can do that, and then you can spend an unlimited amount of money at that point.
If you're over the amount at the time you apply, but it's insubstantial, it would be inconsistent with the document you sign, but it would be consistent with the regulation. And how do you square that?
Well, you would, if you were like $50,001 or something.
Well, I mean, this is our own interpretation of substantial, but let's just go with, in this case, something that we don't know what it is, but it's in excess of it. But the point I'm making is it's inconsistent with the document you sign. So are we trying to say that it's okay to be inconsistent with the document you sign as long as it's insubstantial?
Well, really, you should stick to the $50,000 limit.
Oh, we understand that.
So then the question of whether the commission is nevertheless going to find you eligible even though you've gone over the limit, there's where the substantial comes in. But I think that a candidate should obviously be trying to stick to the $50,000 limit.
Well, we all knew that for sure, right, today, that's for sure. But the point being is, I'm just, at the time the person applies, in theory under the reg, it's still eligible if it's insubstantial. But the document that he's asked to sign does not say substantial, it says didn't do it.
How do you square that? Maybe, I mean, if it's a very small amount of money, he might not think that he actually did exceed the $50,000 limit. I mean, that if it was very insubstantial and he thought it was 49 and it was 51 or something, it's possible that it could be reconciled that way.
So you're saying it turns on his subjective knowledge at the time, if he thought it was 49 but really 51, the substantiality is built in just in case?
Well, the question, as I understood it, was if he's signing the certification that he will not do it, he should be believing that he will not do that. I mean, he shouldn't be saying something he thinks is false on a certification in the 93-3 letter. He should think it's true.
Well, we're all talking hypotheticals, but I'm going to run it by just a little more detail. But at the time, it gives, one could read the reg, not all of them, but this one, to say if substantial, I can sign it. Because in theory, I'm still eligible, if it's insubstantial.
I think all we can do is go back to the regulation. The candidate has to make a certification that he has not exceeded and will not exceed any of the expenditure limitations of 9035. In 9033.3, the standard of decision that is set up for the commission is if the commission makes an initial determination that the candidate's authorized committees have knowingly and substantially exceeded the expenditure limitations. Whatever. Now that's a regulation that was written to cover a lot of territory because it covers both the state and overall limits as well as the personal limit. But that's, if you want to say that there's some wiggle room built into that for the commission, I think you could argue that maybe there is. The candidate is supposed to be able to certify that he has not gone over the limit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just make my comments very brief. I don't really have any questions. I just this matter, as counsel pointed out in the documents that is provided to us, that this presents a novel issue, and we're forced to make a determination about what does substantially exceed the personal expenditure limitation. What does that mean in this particular case? And so. since it is a novel issue, it means we are kind of drawing on a blank canvas in many ways, and so we have to find some sort of, you know, something against which we can compare so that we know whether or not we're even in the ballpark. Some of the factors that I think that seem to be most important to me are we don't have, again, an exact match on this case, but we do have the Buchanan matter, which even though and as you've explained, it does have differences, but it is a matter where an individual took matching funds, exceeded the personal expenditure limit by over $50,000 at the high water mark, was able to pay that down and did not have to repay the funds. As the chairman remarked, it seems like that circumstance is more egregious than the one that we're presented with here. In that case, you have someone who certified that they weren't going to exceed the personal expenditure limit, took public funds, and then proceeded to do so anyway, whereas in this case, we're presented with facts where we have someone who may have exceeded the personal expenditure limit but then cured and came with under that amount to the extent of $47,000, and then basically said, from here on out, I'll be as clean as a whistle. So there, to me, there is a difference. And as counsel pointed out, we also have the Sharpton matter where the limit was exceeded by $66,000. The factor that Senator Gravel in this case cured the excessive amount and brought it back down under, to me, is persuasive. And the fact that, and I don't know if I could be forced to say how I would, if you had a case where someone spent $5 million and then got himself under the $50,000 expenditure limit prior to applying for matching funds, would I make the same determination? That's a hypothetical that I can't really answer right now. But in this case, and under these facts, and again, we have to determine what is substantially exceeding. What does that mean in light of the facts that we're considering today? $23,000 doesn't strike me as substantially in excess of that limit. Again, I realize that we're grasping for the guideposts that we can find, and then finally, it seems like the commission has made an effort to try to interpret our rules with respect to the public financing system in a way that maintains the viability of the program, and I think that was evidenced with respect to the Obama AO, and I think that needs to be taken into account as well. And so, for these reasons, I'm persuaded that in this case that the $23,000 and change over the personal expenditure limit that was then later cured, in my judgment, that does not rise to the level of substantially exceeding the personal expenditure limit.
I agree with my colleagues, the chairman and Commissioner Peterson, in this matter, and I think the chairman has made some very persuasive arguments on a number of fronts. I think it is possible to read the statute in conjunction with the regulations and say at least a possible reading. I'm not saying is necessarily the best one. Possible reading is that there was sort of a moment in time. When you say have not incurred, yes, broadly speaking, that means ever incurred in the past. But it's possible to say have not occurred sort of when you walk into the door. And I think the reason why that's possible is if you do read it with the enabling statute and the section of the ENJ that's quoted in the council's brief, I think that's in some ways one of the only ways to read it. Otherwise, we are really blowing past the statute in a pretty broad way. So I think what I'm saying is if somebody cures and then comes in and says, okay, I'm still behind the limit, then that, to me, is reasonable, not only under the statute, but under the regulations and the ENJ. That doesn't answer the question of whether somebody never cures and then comes forward. I think that's the Sharpton matter, and that maybe is different under the regulations, not under the statute, but under the regulations. So I think in this matter, there are a number of ways of going, but at least one of the ones that I just stated then makes me comfortable that we're following both the statute and the regulations in approving Mr. Gravel's application in this matter. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for my cold. I'm going to respectfully disagree with my colleagues as to the issue of whether this is substantial. I agree that the commission has not taken the opportunity to provide any further guidance on what substantial means. So I'm left with what the rest of the clause of that sentence is, which is the expenditure limitations. And since we're talking about the personal expenditure limitation, to me it is the 50,000 limit, and to me 50% of that is substantial. I do think it is important to start with the certification. If someone comes to us and is able to certify that they can meet all of the requirements and agree to the future action that's required under the program, they're determined to be eligible for funds. In this case, because of the previous amount of the loan, that certification simply isn't possible under the regulation. My view is have not incurred simply means have never incurred. I think I just read that differently than you do. My view is that when the previous commission wrote that language, and I think that's supported by the reading of the explicit language in the ENJ, that they meant perhaps they didn't mean have never in a previous campaign cycle, but I think in my mind this is the campaign that we're talking about, have not incurred such costs. And I think that it's important to me that is consistent with the purpose of this entire program. Congress apparently thought there was too much money being spent in campaigns, and of course this was passed at a time when the dollar amounts were actually so much smaller. It's sort of amusing that they thought that was too much money given what's being spent today. But the purpose was to reduce the overall spending. So it seems to me that reading the regulation as a retroactive requirement is consistent with that purpose of reducing the amount. Otherwise, someone could spend a significant amount of money, repay it, and then still participate in the public funding program. And obviously, there are limits on that. We can't, the government is not allowed to limit expenses unless we're tying it to public money. So we've obviously got, there are limits to this approach. And while I can also appreciate that in the scheme of today's dollars, $50,000 is not very much. Again, I share Commissioner Weintraub's view that we're simply not permitted to read into this statute, this part of the statute, an inflation adjuster. And similarly, I think that is what supports my reading of 90.33.3A about substantially exceeded. If we were dealing with an inflation adjustment, that would have changed with it as well. So unfortunately, I agree with the council's recommendation that I just don't see how we can certify under these circumstances. Thank you.
Anything else?
Well, it's been hard for me. I started off in one direction and I've kind of gone back and forth since then, but I guess in looking since my first voted to approve, I am concerned about the way we provide a different treatment, it seems to me, for someone who's violated the law after they sign this letter as opposed to someone that does before. And in this particular case, $23,000 doesn't seem significant in anybody's world except tying it to that particular law. But in a case like this where it's not a lot of money in big terms, it's not a lot of money in how much money you would get under the system itself compared to if it was a huge amount of money compared to what you get in primary matching funds, so it was close to that. That's a different story. I'm not inclined to read the regulation, which is, I think, possible from 90.35.2 or from the statute, that is a perspective only, because I can see the policy reasons why that could be totally abused. But I think in this particular case, I'm not so uncomfortable with our decision if we just call this insubstantial, and move on, and then do our best to try and find some parameters that we're going to live with in the future, whether it's keyed only to the $50,000 or keyed to other factors. And here the matter was repaid, people were above board, it was done, no one was injured, there was no aggravating circumstances. And so to me, in a case like this, and I know we've done this before with our regulations, sometimes we find ways to ameliorate hardship, whether it's for giving notice for excessives, and there's a lot of times when we try and balance our application here. I see a regulation did add the word substantial kind of out of nowhere, it seems to me, but to me it's fair to look at it that way. So we're really now troubled with how to define the term, and for today's facts I'm comfortable enough to support calling it insubstantial.
Can I ask the council a procedural question? Given what everyone said here, the recommendation is to decline to give Senator Gravel matching funds. If we reject that recommendation, what happens next? Does that mean he gets the matching funds, or is there a separate vote on?
What would happen next is the audit division, which has already informally looked at his threshold submission, would formally look at his threshold submission and send you a memo as to whether he had met the qualifications under that standard, and then you would vote on that, just as you do any other certification of entitlement to an initial disbursement of matching funds. We are in, obviously, because of the lack of a quorum when this first came up, we're in a procedurally unusual posture. And the closest that we have been to this situation was several years ago in a matter involving Lyndon LaRouche, where the commission determined that he was not eligible, and he took us to the D.C. Circuit. And the D.C. Circuit, well after the election, said, oh, yes, he was, and you have to pay him. Mr. Stoltz and Ms. Thomas would know better than I what we did procedurally at that point in the LaRouche matter, but I would assume that we would, at that point, follow whatever procedure that we followed in the LaRouche matter.
We simply put forward a certification, the commission approved it, and the money was paid.
So today, then, we only need one vote on the council's recommendation. If that passes, then he would be denied matching funds. And if it fails, then it goes back in the ordinary course of making sure he has a sufficient support, $250, and the usual analysis everyone else has gone through to get. If that's satisfied, then we get the usual
right. If it failed by a majority, it would go back in the ordinary course.
Okay, so we have a motion. Commissioner Weintraub.
If the desire is to, you would rather have a vote to approve as opposed to a vote to reject, does it make a difference?
I don't know that it makes a
difference. I just want to say, before I make the motion, that I can see I'm going to be in the minority on this, I appreciate my colleagues' efforts to find at least a narrow ground for moving forward on this.
Thank you. Tried.
You tried everything. So with that, I will move approval of council's recommendations with respect to Mike Gravel for president 2008, as set forth in agenda document 08-44.
All in favor of approval of the council's recommendations, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Nay. Motion fails 2-4 with Commissioners Weintraub and Bowerly voting in favor, remaining four voting in opposition. Thank you. That closes our agenda out just about. One public announcement. We're going to have a public hearing on January 14th. There's a notice that's up. Already received some positive feedback. Actually was at I'll call it a think tank panel discussion, that had some folks come up and say they knew, they saw it on the, it's out there, and they thought it was a great idea. It's going to, essentially, anything you want to tell us about our procedures and policies. There was a hearing like this, actually, while Commissioner Weintraub was chair, and many found it helpful. It's been about 5 years, and it made sense to maybe do it again. And I think it also is a way to help educate the commissioners as to historically what's happened. A lot of us are new to the inside, certainly, and it's been an interesting journey, and I think this is a way to help us maybe get our arms around some issues that we otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to take a look at. So there's a notice that the Federal Register will eventually publish, and it may happen today. So for those of you out there who pay attention to such things, there's that, and the comments are due first week of January, I believe, give or take. With that, do we have any management administrative matters to discuss?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? That we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you.